Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, it's Glenn James. This message is being played at the start of all podcasts that Simo Interactive produces. It has come to my attention that there was a licensing issue with the music that we were using for our shows. And until that issue is resolved, and it might take a couple of weeks because I'm overseas at the moment, I've just decided out of an abundance of caution, I would stop using any music until we've resolved the issue. So if you are new to the podcast, you probably won't notice anything different. If it's not your first time, this is why there is no music in the episodes at this time. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the episode.
Today on the show, I'm joined by Mitch King, and this episode we get super practical and talk all things resumes, interviews, cover letters, and showing up on LinkedIn without being a wanker. Mitch has helped companies find good people to employ for the last, I don't know, decade or thereabouts. He's worked at companies like Linktree, and he's now the head of talent acquisition at a business called Mutinex. You're going to love this episode. I think Mitch King is the king of content on LinkedIn as well, so make sure you follow him. And if you want to work on your own LinkedIn, DM him, link in the show notes about how you can find more info about Mitch. Let's go. Mitch King, thanks for joining me on the show today.
No worries. Thank you for having me. I waited a long time since you first invited me.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like I've been hassling you probably every week to be like, hey, can you come on the podcast? Hey, can you come on the podcast? And then finally, we've actually made it happen. So we're going to jump straight in because I have a stack of questions for you when it comes to recruitment. And we haven't done an episode on recruitment, on landing your next role in ages. And so I'm just going to hit you with them. This one comes up all the time, Mitch, from our listeners. It's this question of how do you make your application stand out? So I guess I'm just interested to know, as someone who's been in internal talent acquisition for a long time and seen all kinds of different applications, the good, the bad, the ugly, what do you recommend for people to stand out in a recruitment process?
I feel like I'll let people down because I don't have this secret sauce that you can sort of sell to everyone. I think my cop-out answer is it really depends. I see a lot of LinkedIn resume experts and sort of what they sell. And you can put the belief into people that, oh, if you do this thing, if you have this many words in your resume or this picture of yourself, and that will change the outcome. But sometimes it's just a case of people aren't applying for the right jobs. They're applying at a stretch. They're thinking, well, I could do that job if someone gave me the chance. But there's 400 other people applying who have done that job before or had better sort of, you know, suitability. I think the stuff that I would recommend to people is probably the proactiveness around a job application. So if your strategy to getting a job is simply job board, hit apply, repeat, then you'll more likely be in that category of people who find it takes a while and it's frustrating and you don't sort of hear back. The things that you can do around that can often sort of be better done before you're looking for a job. And networking is maybe that best summary for that. But with an asterisk of, like, I don't like networking at going to events and handing out business cards. I haven't had a business card in, I don't know, how many years. But, you know, LinkedIn, it's sort of part of why I started putting content on there. But even, you know, reaching out to your former colleagues and how are you going, stay in touch. By the way, I'm looking if you hear of anything. Those introductions can be way more effective than any magic sauce in a resume.
Yeah, it's really funny you say the secret sauce. I have wondered, Mitch, are we asking like the wrong question? Like, do you need your application to stand out or do you just need your application to be clear?
Yeah, that's a great point. I get frustrated to the point that I've thought about purely creating content, just arguing with other experts on what advice they're promoting. It seems to be a new generation that suggests that just copy and paste all this information in your resume and that will get you the job. And you're right. Like if I'm helping someone put together their resume, it is hard. Like it's a hard exercise because you're just not thinking about it in the right approach, but you just ask the questions like, well, what does this mean? Give me an example of this. That sort of context or things like you're applying from a job, like where I work at the moment, Mutinex, it's quite a niche company, fairly new. If somebody applies from Mutinex somewhere else, that name might not be instantly recognised. So being able to make it really quick and clear, Mutinex, early stage SaaS company, marketing analytics, that can help that person reading that resume and get that context nice and quickly. It's like, okay, they're in a startup, they're in this role, get the story as quickly as possible. So yeah, I think clearly, concisely, quickly is some of the better frameworks to think about when you're putting that resume together.
I saw you post something the other day on LinkedIn, and by the way, everyone, you have to follow Mitch because Mitch's LinkedIn is he's the best person to follow on LinkedIn. It's hilarious and educational, so it's like the best combo. I just want to say it was so funny. You posted this thing about people not putting their months of employment on the resume. Can you talk to that? Tell us what your thoughts were on that.
I tried to think recently how many resumes I've seen in my life. To be like, how many would that be? And it's tens of thousands. I don't know any more accurately than that. But the example I always give people, if you just put the years, if I put 21 to 22, let's say, and this has happened where I say to people, well, you don't have the months, could you give me those dates? Well, I started in December 21 and I finished in January 22. That's a month, right? Because the next person who does that, Jan 21 to December 22, it's 2 years. Like the wild swing on that is, and I had some of the people, I think, counter argue to that. Well, they're covering over things or they didn't want to show the gap in that. And I understand because there are people that will judge really heavily if you have gaps, and I don't think that makes sense either. But most of the time people are doing themselves a disservice because as your sort of first point, it's not clear. Like if I have to make assumptions, which I never want to do, or I have to investigate further, it's just making a more frustrating experience for the person reading your resume who's probably also reading 50 or 100 as well.
Yeah, it's such a good point as well. I don't think anyone in an internal recruitment role, so talent acquisition, or an external recruiter has the time or desire to go back and follow up on minute details. Like it's just like, and I could be making an assumption there, but I think if you're making the recruiter jump through a hoop to understand your background, you're already on the back foot.
Yeah, I think the caveat I'd put to that is, you know, we think about these resumes, okay, shall we put your resume in front of me? And there's something like that missing. The context is that internal recruiter or external recruiter, they'll look over that if your experience and titles perfectly align to what they're looking for. And this is what I mean about some of the overselling and the importance of resumes. And what I feel like when I'm looking at this advice from people, often who seem quite inexperienced, it's like, yeah, you could do all of that. But if they haven't worked at the right type of environment, company, the right type of position, that resume is still going in the reject pile. It will not save the day. It will not sort of go, oh, all of a sudden, okay, I know you've got no software engineering experience, but geez, the colour palette on this resume is amazing, straightforward to interview. Like that doesn't happen. That's what I feel like is the magic beans that a lot of these experts are selling people at the moment. So, yeah, there's always that caveat.
It's also interesting. I've heard a lot of stuff around resumes no longer being required and cover letters no longer being required. What's your take on that stuff?
Yeah, cover letters I think have always been subjective. Everyone thinks differently about it. And we now have the ChatGPT cover letters. That's the new world that we're in. I reckon I can pick them. I think I'm 9 out of 10, I can pick a ChatGPT cover letter because they're all the same and they're very formulaic in how they approach things. So you say to ChatGPT, here's a job description, write me a cover letter. Firstly, ChatGPT responds in direct order of that job description, of that job ad. And it's just very forced. It's very... So I read cover letters. I read it in this order. Resume, you tick the majority of boxes or you're in, 50-50. Then I see if it's a cover letter. If there's a cover letter and that can give context, then great, that might swing the decision. If that cover letter starts with, "Dear Sir, Madam, Hiring Manager," and it's generic, I'm reading that pretty quickly. But if it's very like, because I always make my profile available on any job that I post, so people know who they're applying to. So if they say, "Hey, Mitch," like that's a tick straight away, because at least you've done that. At least I'm reading something that's meant for me and not just for everyone. So a couple of letters I think have always been hit or miss. And unfortunately for the applicant, you'll probably never know if it's worth it or not until later. Resumes, I got tagged to something recently where someone was saying, well, they'd made the point where resumes were just redundant. And again, there's so much context to that. A resume for me, the whole idea is just a summary. Here's your experience. This is what I've done. Just to say, is it worth us having a further conversation? This person was saying resumes were just redundant, not required. They gave a scenario where they were talking to someone. They're like, "Great, send me your resume and I'll pass it to the hiring manager." And they turned their nose up at that. They've been unemployed for about 7 months. Wow. And they've got their open to work settings on LinkedIn. So you can have these really strong beliefs around, "Oh, I don't think resumes are great, but at the moment, it's the best that we've got." So until there's a better solution to that, you sort of have to play the game as the rules are currently sort of written. So I don't put that emphasis that a resume is going to get you the job. A resume should only get you the interview. And just by sort of being very simple, clear, transparent. If you want to go against it and not use a resume, great, if it works for you. If it's not working for you, then maybe you want to have a resume just in case. They shouldn't take long. It's not the hardest thing in the world to do. Maybe play both sides of that argument just so your bills get paid, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, if you're thinking about the interview process, clarifying your resume and thinking back over your, you know, 10-plus years experience, maybe you do. Maybe you capture your last 10 years of experience in your resume. It's a good cathartic process to go through to just remember, oh, I've done all these things. I've achieved this stuff. Like, I completely forgot that 7 years ago I implemented this tech system that really was this major project, cost the business all this money, and I learned all this stuff. Like, there is something in, like, capturing your achievements that prepares you for the interview anyway. So it's not like I find those moments of I want to get clear on what is it that I've done and then how can I talk to some of these achievements in a really good way in the interview.
Well, it's either cathartic or unearths a whole lot of past trauma that you buried deeply about that company and that job. Like, oh, yeah, that's right. I did miss all of those targets and I did work 80 hours a week. So you had to be careful there. But
and they called us a family. Like, you know, when you think about, like, sure, the work trauma, they're like, they referred to all their employees as family, and that was a bad sign.
I know this is a not great context for an audio platform, but laughing at my own gifts. You know that Kardashian scene where the sisters are fighting? That's what I reference when I say, when companies say they're a family. That, you know, they're trying to kill each other and pull each other's hair out. And, yeah, exactly. That sort of thing. So, yeah, it can, but I agree. I think going back over it, refreshing your memory. And I think if I am in that situation where someone's going through, they're looking for advice, and I did this recently with someone's resume, it just didn't have any detail, no context. You know, they're in sales. And I was like, "What numbers did you do? What percentage of target?" I'm like, "Oh, 150%. I'm like, "Why are you hiding this?" Mm. And it's just that sort of getting out of your own head. And it's almost like the best resume writing tool is really just asking you more questions. Like, you the cliches for me, everyone's dynamic. Every follow-up question to these statements needs to be why, and prove it. Give me an example. It would be an interesting exercise. If I could ever get every resume I've seen into ChatGPT and analyze the words in a word cloud, we're all dynamic, self-starting, quick learners, I'll tell you that.
And passionate.
Passionate, yeah. Even the most boring and mundane jobs, there's a lot of passionate. My wife's a cleaner, so passionate cleaners. I don't think my wife would ever say she was passionate about cleaning. She likes what she does, but I don't think it's a passion.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really going away from those buzzwords, like you're saying, and giving the detail of what you actually achieved is way stronger as a pitch. And I think you can do that in a concise way on a resume.
Yeah.
I think you're right about getting out of your own head, because the other side of this for me, when you think about putting yourself out there in any context, it might be applying for a job, it might be putting yourself out there to take on a like new project or new role at work or ask for a promotion, whatever it is, I think we fall prey to like this, the curse of knowledge, where we forget, and I see this so much, Mitch, for internal applicants. Like this is so big for internal applicants. We assume people know all the things that we know. And so then we don't talk about it in a way that people understand, because we're just like, well, I could assume you've worked in recruitment, so you must understand the fullness of HR, when actually we know that's not the case. Like I don't understand the fullness of recruitment end to end. You haven't worked in the technical HR space. Correct me if I'm wrong. No, okay.
I stay clear on that.
Yeah, so we make assumptions, and that's where I think we slip up. We don't tell people the details of our achievement, like that person you were saying got 150% above their targets.
Mm.
But they didn't know to put that down and communicate that.
Yeah, and I think I'd probably summarise that people write their resumes for themselves. They're not thinking about the person reading it. So with that context of, and I think this then follows through into the interview, like some of the best communicators, which is strong communication. I don't think there's a job in the world that doesn't require that or look for that. I'm over-exaggerating. There probably is, but people who can think about the context that the person reading or speaking to does have or is missing. And I think some examples like a lot of the technical roles that I interviewed for, some people, you ask them a question, they'll just go super hard into the most, all these acronyms and technical terms. And then the really good communicators are like, they'll ask me first, how much do you know? What level do you want? And in a lot of businesses, startups that are working, those technical people at some point need to talk to a non-technical person. And what makes them really good and stand out is they can adjust their language based on who they're speaking to. And that's the same as a resume. What I recommend to most people is the person reading your resume at the first point often isn't a technical subject matter expert. So, but what they're looking for is just alignment to, what they've been told. So you need to speak to them first, because that gets you the interview. Once you're in the interview, you can give more information then and explain it. You don't have to give everything in that resume.
I love that around we write our resume for ourselves, not for the audience. And I think you're so right. Like we often forget when we're communicating who's reading or who's listening. Like in the interview, it is so important to simplify and remove as much of that jargon as possible. Like those things are confusing. If you can take them out, I don't know, like sometimes I think people do this because they use technical jargon because maybe they think it makes them sound smarter, but I think the opposite happens. Mm. We end up sounding confusing and it's convoluted.
Yeah, and I think this is like just something that I've just become really so passionate about, really, enthusiastic about, is that simple language and that school of thought where, okay, if I say all these big words, I'm going to, be more impressive. But often you just alienate people, rather than take them on a journey that's a little too hyperbolic, but take them through the context, get them through each sort of stage. So an interview is a good example, right, where I think probably this happens 10 times a day where someone just goes really fast and hard into giving me information that I haven't asked yet. So just, okay, let's start the interview. What's your situation? Are you still working for this company? 10 minutes later, I know about the project, but it's like, I just wanted that question and then, we'll go further. So whether it's people, I think sometimes they over-prepare. And so if I've got to get all this information out and they feel like they've got to get it out straight away, and just that listening, responding to the question, being mindful of who you're speaking to, all that sort of stuff there, it seems simple. But then when it's that resume part, the advice I've always given to people, if you don't want to use a resume writer, and in asterisks, I don't know if I know many or any good ones. Apologies if I do and I've forgotten about you. But the best thing you can do is get someone in your family or friendship group that doesn't know what you do and ask them to explain back to you what you do after reading your resume. Grandparents is always a good one for me. Unfortunately, my grandparents are gone, so I lost that in my resume. But, yeah, read this, explain what you get from this, and you'll find a lot of the missing gaps there.
That's such a good test. Someone who doesn't know or isn't familiar with your role to come back to you, and especially if you work in a technical space, like think about anyone who's in software development or in engineering or any of those technical spaces where possibly the first person looking at a resume is someone from HR, and they don't know the ins and outs of civil engineering.
Yeah, and engineering is a good one. Yeah, you'd like, you get all these engineer resumes, okay, how do I filter this down? Well, the CTO told me that we're looking for React and JavaScript. And so seeing those words, which, again, a lot of people think, well, of course that would be on the resume. Some engineers will just be like, I'm an engineer. I built this project. And it's like, I just need to understand, like, have you used the tools that they're asking for, you know, to help me out as well. And then the more technical stuff comes out during the interview, you know. So, yeah, it's sort of stage-gated.
What do you think, let's talk about the interview for a sec. Again, we haven't spoken about interviews in ages on the podcast. So I'd love to know, Mitch, what do you think have been some of the interview fails you've seen, and what are the interview wins that you've seen?
I mean, the things the only one I think are fails, just the, I had one not too long ago where it just, the whole interview, that it was clear this person was thinking of a different company. Every answer they gave me was just not what we are as a company. You know, like, I love government and I love the rigor and structure. And I don't want to give them the answer. So I'm like, okay, cool, write that down. You know, what was it about this job? You know, those sorts of questions. And whether it's a simple mistake of they're too busy at work and they got their interviews mixed up. So that preparation, you know, is there. I think in the wins, it's a good one because I haven't thought, you know, prepared ahead of like what are the best interview wins, except for some of the people that we've hired recently, and just that dynamic or the relationship we have with them during the process. You know, like there is, you call them and there's a conversation or there's context, or what questions they ask just shows that they're engaged and interested. Well, they've done a little bit more. So maybe sort of treating that interview process or that relationship with the recruiter or hiring manager, whoever it is, I don't think it necessarily changed the outcome of the process. You know, they were going to get the job regardless of that, or maybe it tipped them over the edge in terms of it came down to, you know, two really good people and just that communication and personality sort of really shone through during those touch points.
I think that when it comes to an interview, that opening 5 minutes to me is like make or break. And I don't know why I think that, like, because I know and I'm conscious that, I don't know, I just think that first question or, you know, one of those early questions where it's like, you know, tell me a bit about yourself. And then I've had interviews where people have like waffled on for 15 minutes about themselves and I'm just like, oh, I've totally switched off. I'm disengaged. Like, well, I think if you can do that opening 5 minutes and do it strongly without coming across as scripted, but just bring some personality and warmth to it and connect with people early. But what's your take on that?
I'll play both sides of this argument. Firstly, I don't like that question.
Like, oh, good. Tell me why.
I think for a lot of people, and particularly when you get into the neurodiversity realm, it's just such a broad question that, like, when people ask me that question when I'm interviewing, I usually caveat in saying, I assume you don't want to know about my high school basketball career. So I'm going to start at this point. Like, I'm going to fast forward to the last 5 years and focus on professional. Because the people that tell me about yourself, like, do you want to know about my interests? Do you want to know that I've never touched that exercise bike behind me, that they're from Kmart, those prints? You know, like, what do you want to know? Like, ask me specifically what you want to know. But I think in people who, again, I know lots of people who, you know, I feel really strongly about those bad interview questions, but play the game. Understand that that question might be asked. So give that response, that context. Be like, okay, I'm going to start from here and focus on this. If I miss anything that you're wanting to hear, let me know. And I think the waffling one's a good one, because I think even if you are asked a really open-ended question, people who aren't mindful of waffling, again, for a communication standpoint, I don't know many companies that actively seek long, waffly communicators. You know, they want that. And so stop and ask a question. Like, I've given you 2 minutes. Did that cover everything, or do you want me to go into X? That, to me, is a good sign that people, you know, will stop and check. And it happens a lot. Like, my job in these viewers is to make sure I control that and it doesn't go on for too long. But if you're worried about it and you, like, I'm just going to test this again, and I've seen 12 minutes answers, it will be at some point a red flag for someone if you can't be mindful of how long you've been talking for.
Mm. And it's such a common thing when people get nervous that they feel like, oh, I need to keep adding and adding and adding to this. But I think the ability to kind of go, I'm going to give this insight, and know that a good interviewer or even an average interviewer will know to ask follow-up questions. Like, if you haven't given the level of detail, like, they'll ask you a follow-up question. But what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good point, because I believe quite strongly that there's a whole population of people who aren't really good at their job that are really good interviewers, and the opposite. There's a whole, and sometimes, like, I meet with someone or they reach out to me for advice or the friend of a friend, and I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe you're not confident going into interviews. Like, I've worked with you. You're amazing. Look at everything you've achieved. But some people, interviews are just like an irrational fear for them. And I think what maybe people don't do, one, acknowledge it. If, you know, say, I'm not good at interviews, then seek help around it. You know, interview training, again, this can be done with friends. You could seek out people who will, you know, you can pay to do this sort of stuff, and get that sort of feedback and get that practice and get those reps in. Some people do it. I've spoken to people every once in a while. They're like, interviewing just to keep the skills up, just to sort of, so that they might, maybe they don't interview for another year or two, but they interviewed every 3 to 6 months just to blow the rust off, blow the cobwebs off, and keep that sort of going. So it is a skill. It can be learned. It can be better. And I remember once we interviewed someone a couple of years ago, just thought, she's so good, but just bombed the interview. And luckily that it's actually one of the founders agreed and reached out and gave them time for feedback and questions and to help them get to that point, because it just seemed like it was such a shame. Such a talented, this was a creative role, so you could see the talent. But just on the interview, it was just like, oh, it's just not there. So it is a skill. It's a skill that can be learned and can be improved and can be forgotten as well.
And you're so right. Some of the people who are the strongest in an interview, and they have this like level of like charm and charisma and like they nail it, they get in the job and you're like, oh, wow, you kind of fooled us all, because I don't think you can do this job. And I don't know, like, how do they go into the interview and see it as more of a conversation? Like, how do we move it from this kind of like clinical, like ask a question, answer a question, like to conversations? Because I think when it is a conversation, it's a lot better for everyone. Yeah, but it's hard to move it into that dynamic when there's kind of this power dynamic in the room.
There is. And it's also hard when you interview with companies that don't want that. There are, and maybe it's the more corporate ones. And I remember interviewing at one place and very strong advocates for the STAR technique, and there's 3 people and it's like your question, your question, your question. And you almost start to feel like they're so robotic, they must want robotic back. And it's probably not true that over the time. It's a good question. I'm trying to think how to get that from, you know, something I find very unhelpful is telling someone who's not confident, you know, just be confident. Doesn't not help at all. And saying that, and I think it might, again, just come back to those repetitions and just practicing. And if you might start to go through this checklist and go, I don't have a mentor, I don't have anyone that I've worked with that I could trust. That might start to actually reveal some other things you need to work on in terms of maintaining your network, your relationships, understanding who's who in your industry. Yeah. But I think proactively seeking that and testing it, getting feedback. And sometimes hard, because I'm the sort of person that if somebody comes to me and they want help and the feedback I need to give them is that's not very good, I will tell them that because I believe that's going to be helpful for them. Whereas a lot of people don't feel comfortable in giving that feedback and will like, yeah, that was great. And then hang up and go like, oh, shit, that person's horrible. And, you know, that doesn't help. So you've got to sort of seek out someone who, class myself as an asshole, but someone who you know will give you the truth.
Mm.
That's the person you need in your life.
Yeah, it's very true. I was watching a video on Instagram the other day of someone saying that when you ask people for feedback about how you present in a meeting or how you interview, for example, very few people will give you helpful constructive feedback. And I thought that's actually very true. Like I think you have to find the right person. If that means you pay for a service to get someone to actually sit down with you and do the training, do that interview training, it's worth it in my opinion if it changes the whole pace of you getting that next job.
Now I'm just thinking of like a service where you're just like, wins an asshole, you know, to give you really blunt feedback, which I think I'd be amazing at.
Well, you might have a new career path.
Yeah, if anyone wants that service. But no, it's right. And I think on the inverse, and this probably goes more into your territory in HR, where transparency, and I've found I've been in environments where everyone's like, we want transparency, it's all I want. And then I get a little dose of it and like, oh, no, not like that. That's too transparent. It's like, well, now we're going to need a spectrum of transparency. Because when I think, okay, you want transparency, and I say, I thought, and there's a difference, there's a line between just giving someone negative and unconstructive feedback versus, you know, constructive feedback that they can get better from. But if you can get that line, the people who are receiving it understanding really their own ability to take that and how much transparency they want. Though there was a situation real eye-open for me where I was like, transparency, great, I love that. And then 50% of the people were like, whoa, too much transparency. Like we want some, you know, some filters on this. So there needs to be a duality to that, you know, like come and I'm seeking transparency, but you've got to be okay if the feedback that you get isn't positive.
Ah. You are so bang on. I've been thinking heaps lately that I think this could be a total overreach by me, but I'm just going to say, I reckon the biggest thing that kills people's career is defensiveness. Like if you're defensive to feedback, if you're defensive when people try and help you grow and learn or give you some tough truths, you really stop your own growth. Like, and I see this all the time on teams, Mitch, that I'm working with to improve their culture. And I'm like, yeah, we do want to be honest with each other as long as the honesty is positive.
Yeah.
It's like, wait.
In my head, I've developed this like a website or a tool where basically ask people about 20 questions about scenarios and transparency and get them to choose a few options and it'll give them like a transparency score. You know, so Shelley got sacked because she was crap at Excel. Shelley was sacked because she wasn't hitting key markers of the role. Shelley's decided to part ways. Like, which of these statements are you more comfortable with? And then that will align you to the right level of transparency to what you are. And because it's just for me, sometimes I probably do think black and white. I think transparent and I think you see everything and you give everything and that's it. But only through, you know, other experience, I realised that transparency, there's gradients to it and people sort of being in the right. Even that manager dynamic, you know, if your manager has, and I've had this, it's like I've got this person, I just tell them everything straight out and they're like, great, thank you, I'm going to be better. And I say the same thing to the next person and they're like, mental breakdown, quit, I hate you, never speak to me again. It's like, holy shit, I just did the exact same thing. And, you know, then we get to the manager side, it's like, oh, right, so you can't just do the same thing for everyone. You've got to adjust it.
Totally. And I think it's such an art form to find where the person you're giving feedback to fits on that continuum of wanting like it to be brutally honest through to wanting it to be softened and toned down and like, well, whatever. But I think it does go to the point that if you want to do a good job of an interview, you have to practice. And I think there's a couple of ways. Like, I practice a lot of stuff that I do on the podcast, or a lot of stuff that I do in my business. I do heaps of voice. I don't know if people hate this idea, but I do heaps of voice memos and listen back and go, oh yeah, I said like way too many times, or I said, and it's painful, or I said, or I have heaps of filler words. And so listening back, you can give yourself that feedback. It is painful. And I reckon it's more painful than someone else giving you the feedback, but it's one way to do it if you don't have someone in your world who's going to give you honest feedback.
Yeah, I don't even like the idea of that, to be honest. Like, I hear my own voice. Like, I think even, I don't offend anyone whose podcast I have been on, I don't think I've listened to any of them back. Like, it's out there, good, it's done. I like having the conversation, but listening to myself, I think I'm so self-critical that the whole time I'll just be like, oh, you sound crap. You're an idiot. You spoke too long. So, yeah, it is, but I do like that. Seen a few people talk about or share their journeys with like rejection therapy, where they've been given a task of like approaching 100 strangers and that sort of thing. And while you don't have to go that far, I think that rejection therapy sort of mindset can help people when it comes to like interviews. It's like just being out there more. You know, maybe you interview for 5 jobs and you think you want them or they're in the right ballpark, you're not live or die. But then when that 6th one comes up and that's the job that you've won, it's come to a purpose. Those previous 5 interviews helped you get a little bit better. You know, every once in a while, I know it's rare to get feedback from companies, but if someone did give you good feedback and you can go like, great, I worked on that, improved it, and that got you the job. So yeah, I think it still just comes back to that repetition. But I agree, like doing that slightly uncomfortable exercise, whatever it might be, I think will help the people who are in that. But I guess we're speaking about the persona of people who are struggling with confidence. We haven't addressed the opposite, where it's like, tone that shit down a bit, please. Because that's also common, where people are just straight out. It's always been a curious thing for me. You see it in cover letters. I'm the best person for this job. So how would you ever know that? Who are you comparing yourself to? What context do you have about who you're competing with for this job? This is why I believe that blanket advice that Mike is, we'll have this conversation. It's not always people struggling to present themselves in the right way with enough confidence. Sometimes people go way overboard.
Why do you think people do that?
It's probably a few different ways. I think of the examples. Now, this is a joke, so no one get offended. If you're in sales, that's one. That's one reason why you do that, for that personality type. It happens a lot in recruitment. I remember I pulled a guy up once. He called me and told me he was in the top 10% of recruiters in Melbourne, and I asked him what percentage I was in because I'd never seen the list. You know, and that threw him because it's like, well, hang on, you know, how am I making this claim?
That's so awesome.
There is people that, you know, they've bought into another school of thought, which is you have to be this expert and you have to know everything, which is sometimes true. And those people often fall into the category of they're not that great at their job, but they're great interviewers for the company who doesn't know what they're looking for. Sometimes it's false bravado. They're not actually that type of person, but they're trying to play the part they've been told or they think they should play. So I don't think it's necessarily a one size fits all, and it's also dependent on the interviewer's appetite. Not everyone. Some people love that. Some people want confidence. Again, things like cliches like sales, they probably want a little bit of arrogance sometimes in being able to handle that job. But it depends. You need to sort of almost interview someone and then give them feedback and say, this is my impression of you based on that. And my impression is still in my opinion as well.
I think that lack of humility goes down like a lead balloon. Like if you, that idea of coming across too strong and like really saying I'm in the top 10% of recruiters in Melbourne, like that would just like totally throw me off. Cause I'm like, wait, why, how do I know that's true? And tell me, where did you get this empirical data from, please? But I was doing this interview the other day with like one of my favorite authors, and it was one for me. I was like totally fangirling. I was like so nervous and excited to have this conversation. And so I was interviewing him about his books. He's written, you know, over 4 books, sold millions of copies. And he did this thing, Mitch, that was amazing. Like, I asked him this question and he's just like, look, I don't think I can give you a good answer for that. I really don't know. But can I ask you, why do you think that matters? And blah, blah, blah. And he asked a really good follow-up question. But I was like, it was so refreshing to sit across from someone who is just humble enough to go, you know what, I don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah, and there's something that's in a similar vein to what I was saying before about the simple language and that sort of thing. And a lot of people sort of come to me with like what I write about, how I write on LinkedIn and being comfortable with that, because I've never tried to position myself as an expert in anything. But I will ask a lot of questions. Well, what does everyone think? Like, is this good? Is this bad? And for me, it's more curiosity, I think, will play a lot into it. And just being in, I think we've probably all been in those situations where you're working with someone who gives that impression like they've got everything under control, but they don't. But, you know, in a specific scenario, if you went back to that meeting 4 weeks earlier and they said, I actually don't really know, what do you think, or can I have another week to get back and then present that? But it's just that fear of like expectation that you need to know everything. Whereas if probably 95% of us are honest with ourselves, we're all trying to figure it out on the go. And, you know, we know some of the frameworks to these solutions, but it's not the same solution for everyone. So it can be daunting for some people to maybe admit that they don't know. But as you said, it was really refreshing for you, right? And not that I get every interview that job that I've interviewed for, but I've had that feedback where people be like, what we liked was you didn't say you knew everything, or you asked us questions that other people didn't ask. I questioned, there was one example where I questioned why they wanted that. And the feedback was that no, everyone else had sort of provided their solution. I was like, hang on, can I ask why we're going down this path straight away? Because, you know, X, Y, and Z. I think it's hard because it will depend on the interviewer as well and what they're, it's like personal preferences. It's, I think the cliche has been done to death, but it is like dating. You know, I'm sure we all have ex-partners who you just think are absolute, you know, nightmares, but somebody else married them. it's just preference and taste and all those sorts of things. So there isn't one person that, or one approach that fits everyone.
And I think that goes to why you need to show up and be yourself. Like, I know that's so cliche as well. Like, but if you try and project an image, like you try and come across as something you're not, and you end up getting the job, the expectation is you're going to be that person ongoing. Whereas if you're honest and authentic, you're curious and like for you, Mitch, if you're kind of in the interview saying, oh, I'd love to understand how you got to this, why that is a priority, they're going to know that you're going to come in and want to have questions or have questions about the strategy, about the direction. And so the more you show up in an authentic way, and I'm not saying like be unprofessional, but what I'm saying is if you're you and authentic in that interview, you're going to find someone who aligns better with you anyway.
Yeah. And I think you almost, although people probably want every job they interview for, sometimes it's better to realize that you're not aligned. You know, you come out be yourself and that's not what they wanted or they're looking for. You might have saved yourself 3, 5, 6 months of like stress and needing to find another job or performance management, all those sorts of things. So the more, transparent you are about who you are and what you're looking for and what you do know and what you don't know. I did it for my job at Mutinex and, you know, being a startup, I hadn't had talent acquisition before, and as you probably know, HR and talent acquisition often get just thrown into the same pool. And I was speaking to some people I was interviewing, they were like, oh, that's a red flag, they don't know what the job is. So, it's a bit of a weird job. Early stage company, it's fine. It's basically put together like, here's a list, or here's a matrix. Like, I can do this by myself. I can do this a little bit, maybe with, you know, external help or a bit of time. I can't touch any of these things. So I'm just really clear with you. If that's a match, great. If you want this side, then you're actually probably looking for like a head of people and culture or something like that. So again, it's a context-based example, but I think if people are comfortable in saying, you know, really well, not too bad, want to learn or never want to touch, that whole transparency piece becomes a lot easier for both parties.
Yeah, because if you're going to sign up to work full-time at some job, you want to know that you're actually going to like it. I want to segue because I think you mentioned before LinkedIn. I want to ask you for your LinkedIn advice because I swear you are the best at this. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mitch is going to tell us all the things you need to know about LinkedIn, and I promise you need to know these things. If you want to grow in your career, I just wanted to remind you about our book, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Glenn James and I have written this book to help you with any kind of career crisis, but also those things that you want, like getting a promotion, making more money, moving into a leadership role, or if it's time to quit your job. You can find our book wherever you get good books from, or you can listen on the audiobook, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Now let's get back to the show.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay, Mitch, I want to ask you a question about LinkedIn because LinkedIn, I keep seeing all these memes about LinkedIn being like the cringiest place on earth, but I have to say it's changing, right? Don't you think it's changing?
I do, and I've seen that a lot on, you know, other platforms like X, as it's now called, Reddit, and that sort of thing. And X in particular, I almost want to sort of stand up and fight back for LinkedIn because it's just a different level of cringe, like, or different type of cringe on all these platforms. LinkedIn does have the humble braggers and, you know, all those sorts of things. The one that really just does my head at the moment is people who write on whiteboards and hold the message, like this really generic, people don't leave companies, they leave bad managers, agree. It's just like there's so many free tools to use to write that same message or just type it. Put your whiteboards away. but it's no different to Instagram and, you know, people with their shirts off and wearing bikinis. And X and Twitter is just full of experts in how to get $10,000 in revenue a month in 90 days and crypto. And it's just different styles of it. But I think all social media has this. It's just LinkedIn is so dominant in the career space. But it does feel like, I mean, if anyone who was on LinkedIn years ago, I don't know when I first started using LinkedIn, must be about 2013 or something. It was a wild west back then. The number of like, not funny memes, like solve this puzzle and that sort of stuff. It was super cringy back then. And I posted about this recently. I think once you get on there and if you actually just block and mute and unfollow the people doing the cringe, it unleashes all of the good stuff, and there's so much good stuff there. But I was saying to my wife on the weekend, I found the setting in LinkedIn, I didn't actually know it was there, where you can see the list of everyone you've muted and unfollowed. Mine's about 220, I think, people that I've, you know, done that to. So my feed's really clear and really, like, nice, but I do see that cringe, and this is what I'm finding when I'm speaking to people about who are wanting help with writing their LinkedIn content. And I'm seeing some of the other LinkedIn content experts, and again, no offense, I don't know you, probably got a great business, but I could just never write in the style they write, or I could never advise people to do the things that they do because it just feels really templated and forced, and that I'm an expert, follow me, I'm selling you magic beans. That's what it always feels like, whereas the people I like the most, it's usually sharing information, teaching, you know, you learn. They're the best ones, I think, yeah, ones you can sort of learn from or relate to. So I do think I will defend LinkedIn, but also I do see it sometimes. I know what people are referring to, but I see it and I block it and then I never see it again.
How do you think LinkedIn helps people in their career?
I think we sort of circle back. What sort of corporate wanker just
turned up? You sound like a HR person.
Circle, touch base. Back to the original sort of point, we're talking about job applications. For me, it's no different to any other form of marketing where it's brand awareness. So there was, like, when I started posting on LinkedIn, there was probably two or three major reasons. One, I hated my majority of what I was seeing. In recruitment, it was like, is this going to be better for me to be able to reach candidates and reach clients? Because recruiters are all cold call, 50 a day. I was like, this feels so stupid. I don't want anyone to call me if I don't know them. Why would I call them? So you're out there and then it's like giving advice or sharing resources, whatever it is. And then say from a job perspective, it's like, oh, hang on, I've seen this name before. I know this person. I have an understanding of what they sort of stand for, believe, you know. So that sort of, if you want to stand out and from an applicant standpoint, it's like being known prior. Mm. That helps. The examples I give is my last two jobs have come directly from LinkedIn, not applying for a job, but being approached because I've put a message out or I've put content out. Now, that's not going to happen if you post once every year, but if you don't like, you know, the job searching process and applying and resumes and all that sort of stuff, then it can be worth doing from the career's perspective, definitely. And then it's led to me, like, I've done a couple of, I mean, I wouldn't be this podcast, right, if it wasn't on LinkedIn. I've done a few talks and events. So that helps boost your profile. And while probably the market that I think I'm going to try to target most in terms of helping from a content perspective is the introverts. I don't like the attention or the profile or being known, but it helps. It helps with my job. If I'm trying to find a candidate, if I'm looking for a job, it helps in that regard. So I'm not doing it to be the center of attention, but if people are aware of you, it means those cold approaches, those cold calls, they're warm now.
Yeah. And you're so right. Like, I think you don't wake up in the morning and think, gee, I can't wait to put myself out there on social media. Like, I mean, maybe some people do, but I absolutely don't do that. They probably do. There's probably people listening who love that. Honestly, I feel like it's the most, like, draining thing emotionally. But you know what? You're 100% right. It absolutely works for creating opportunities. And it might not be immediate. It could be, like, long game. Someone saw you from that company that was amazing and they saw you over a year ago and they're like, hey, can we talk to you about this new opportunity? You're not even actively applying for roles, but all of a sudden someone's come to you because of you consistently showing up online on LinkedIn. So I am the bloody biggest advocate for being present on LinkedIn because I think it has a huge impact on your career.
Yeah, and like some of the people started putting feelers out, like, do people actually want help with this? Are they feeling uncomfortable about posting? And I'm collecting feedback from them on why they don't. And a lot of it's the same. You know, the options I've got from select from is fear of looking stupid. It's probably the number one. And it's that sort of perception of, well, everyone's already doing it. What's the point of me doing it? And I think there's that false sort of thought of, like, you're competing with everyone. So it's like you're not. You're a different area of expertise, you're different locations, you've got different beliefs. It's not about, are you the number one or do you have this many likes? And it does work. You don't have to do it if you don't want to, you don't see the value, and if you don't need it. If you're always getting jobs, always getting approached, you're a senior software engineer that's worked in FANG companies, don't bother. But if it is a case of you want to boost that profile, you want some opportunities that you're not getting. I was talking to someone recently and they want to sort of create a transition. It's like, well, why don't you say that? You're not employed right now. Why don't you say, this is what I can do, this is what I'd like to do. Put that out there as part of the other content, and someone sees that, it's like, oh, that's great, because we need that now, but we might need that later. So those sorts of opportunities, I think people maybe think they don't happen when they do a lot, that sort of job or that sort of connection.
And how do you, if you think about your own experience with LinkedIn and then the people that you're kind of coaching and helping in this space, how do you get started? Like, how do you create that first kind of post?
I think that, probably the getting started part is a lot of people's block at getting started is I think they're trying to do the perfect one on the first post. It's like, they're going to be Simon Sinek and this is going to turn into a quote. And it was really the way the LinkedIn algorithm works. You're better off throwing out 20 shit ones before you even do anything good. Just to firstly realize that no matter what you post, never really, one post never really changes the world that much. Unless you're doing something stupid and having a hot take and being overly political and things like that. But it's a lot of numbers games. You don't have to do high volume, but the algorithm wants you to be consistent. So you've got to turn up a couple of times a week for a month. And the analogy I use to people is if you walk into a bar and started yelling, people are just looking at what the hell, turn around and ignore you. But if you went to that bar and yelled three times a week, eventually they'd be like, I know this person. I might listen to them now. Actually, they've got something good to say. So that sort of getting started is probably that rejection therapy. It's just put something out there. It doesn't really matter what it is. Just put something out there. Put out there why you're going to start posting on LinkedIn. And the other one that comes along is people don't have ideas. And the few sessions, I guess, it's in beta, I don't know how to say it. It's a beta mode. And you sort of have a conversation with someone and you're like, so while I'm talking to them, you write down a few points. You're like, there's six posts we just spoke about. It's just that sort of being mindful, writing things down. Okay, who did I speak to today? What was that meeting about? How did I feel? What did that client say? What did my friends say? And always got sort of examples of that. So eventually I had to learn just to capture ideas when they come to me, because that's always random. And then I'm not sitting and writing from scratch because, again, maybe the third most common reason is it takes people too long. Mm. So I don't spend ever more than 5 to 10 minutes writing.
Really?
And that, people are always like, I don't want to spend as much time as you do on LinkedIn. It's like, hey, well.
Chill.
I'm not spending time on LinkedIn either, because while the returns are worth it, the returns aren't worth it if you're spending hours every day, doing this, producing this, unless it's a, direct sales funnel for you. But you can get quicker and maybe just get more comfortable with the fact that sometimes you post something and it won't go anywhere. Some posts just won't perform. Some you just won't get likes. And I think from the feedback people have given so far, that's daunting for them. I'm going to put myself out there. And I think the same, I've thought about doing video content on other platforms. And I'm like, can I? It's a bit, but it's a different sort of cringe. But then I'm like, it's exactly the same way I felt when I started posting on LinkedIn. I still feel that way sometimes when I post. I'm like, I don't think this one's going to be very cool. But then usually those ones are the ones that perform the best. So eventually I'm just like, I'll just ignore it. Just going to post it. Again, I'm not going to force anything. I'm not going to post for the sake of posting. But, just the consistency in turning up, it has payoffs for those different reasons.
I woke up this morning. Well, it wasn't directly after I woke up, but I did check LinkedIn most mornings. And I jumped on and I saw a post from one of our listeners. And I'm just going to bring it up and tell you what she said. Bear with me. One of our listeners who listened to last week's episode where I shared a story about someone posting on LinkedIn and within 3 days they got their next job. So they posted similar to what you said, I'm looking for this. And then Sammy, one of our listeners said, hey, LinkedIn, I'm taking a leap of faith. Listen to the latest episode. And now then she kind of goes into describing what she's looking for in her career transition. And I think when you see people do that and then get all these comments and all these responses from people, so there's something really cool, I think, about saying that what you need by way of help, what help do you need? And put it out there. If you need people to help you in your career because you're stuck and you're job seeking and you're not getting much luck, find a way to put it out there and communicate it. That to me is such a leap of faith and terrifying moment. But the payoffs are huge, as opposed to just sitting around and hoping that something will come along and fall into your lap.
And I think it's on the other side as well, I find a lot of people, and I spoke to someone the other day about this, who They felt they had to be an expert in what they were talking about in the sort of engineering space. And it felt like they, and what we discussed was they were trying to be an expert for the most senior people in market. I was like, what about those midweights? What about those juniors? What about those career transitioners who would just love someone to explain, this is what this means, and or this is how I got here? And so that relatability piece and, you know, being someone that shares and is approachable, you know, and authentic rather than the untouchable expert, you know, I just think it goes a lot further, and people's mindset of, like, pretty much everyone knows more about something than somebody else. So you could be a junior, but there's a grad or there's someone studying and they're going to get, well, a couple of them on LinkedIn, not a lot, but it could be, again, a career traditional, or you're putting content out there and a hiring manager's like, I really like how this person talks and how they go about it. I'm going to ask them if they want a job here. So there's so many different ways of approaching it, but again, I think sort of coming down to that fear of like for me, I think if I put content out there that was saying, this is the one way you have to run a talent acquisition team, and that would be really daunting because I'm like saying, I'm the expert, this is the other way to do it. Whereas I'm more prone to be like, I've seen these three ways, what do people think? And what do you think from a different perspective?
And I think that's one thing you do really well. You spark like conversation. I think if anyone's starting out, it's a really good way to just put an idea and then ask a question, and then you get conversation. It might not be that you feel like you're getting as many likes, but if you generate conversation, it's better anyway. And then you don't feel like you're having to position yourself as the one best expert in talent acquisition. I'm going to ask you one more thing, and then just before we close, because, okay, two things actually. Number one, I saw that you were ranked number 40-something in Australia and New Zealand top LinkedIn influencers. And who are you right behind in that ranking? Tell us.
Bloody, the king of Engadine, bloody ScoMo.
It was ScoMo and then Mitch King.
Yeah, it's the only thing I took out of that list, to be honest, because I wasn't, you know, I'm not aware of this list. I don't exactly know how they calculate it. I don't put any thought into it, but then just seeing, and it was weird, just like ScoMo above me, it's like, there's one person I was going to be, could it have not been that? And then Jacinta Ardern was two behind me, and I'm like, this, I think as soon as I saw that, I was like, I'll never lose sleep over this list. I could fall off it and I wouldn't care. I could never, ever be ahead of a list of Jacinta Ardern in anything. Unless it's like beard growth, she should always be in front of me. There's no other reason for her to be two spots behind me on any list.
But I just loved it. I laughed so much at your post. But I think anyone who is wanting to learn about LinkedIn, you are the master at this. You're very relatable, super fun, super engaging, always generating really good conversation. And you do have a coaching program, and people can go on the wait list for this.
Yeah, it is a wait list. I'm trialing with a few people, and I think to sort of some of the points earlier when people started asking me to come to me advice and, you know, how do I do this? And I look and I get people on my feed and they're the experts, you know, and I look at them and go, well, you're putting this stuff out there. And just the more I looked at them, it's just like I saw one, again, probably, well, I don't say probably not listening, that's offensive to your podcast, but someone was offering like a LinkedIn profile design service, and it included like custom banners, custom like carousel templates. It's $2,000. I'm like, I could never care about someone's LinkedIn profile banner enough to use anything but a free Canva template, you know, for that. So it's sort of what I'm trialing in sort of who I'm coaching are the people who want to be themselves, want to be authentic without being cringy, LinkedIn wankers, whatever you want to call it. I think if people are really actively seeking to be like, I want 20,000 followers, I want to be expert, I want to be number one on that list, I'm not the person for them. But if it's just breaking down those barriers to like getting started, being themselves, getting some structure to write content faster so it doesn't take you hours and therefore it's not a burden to do, that's what I'm trialing. But I'm only going to keep it because I've got a full-time job, I've got kids, I've got a dog, got a pool in summer. I'm only going to do it in sort of small groups You know, so keep with a couple of people, help get them started, maybe keep them coaching if they want that, if they sort of see the value. It's early days, but feedback so far has been good. It's been quite fun just to sort of have those conversations with people and be like, why aren't you doing this? Like, a lot of it seems to be like confidence building more than anything sort of content. A lot of it is just, that's good, make this slight change, do that 5 times a week, you'll be golden.
And everyone who's listening will know that you're going to give them the honest feedback. That is worth absolutely paying every cent for, to get honest feedback. Final question, how do people find out more about you? Best way to find you on LinkedIn?
LinkedIn, yeah, search Mitch King. I think my URL is like LinkedIn/Mitch King. Is that Mutinex, MUTINEX, then that's the guy. That's probably the best way. I haven't, again, gone to the lengths of setting up fancy websites or anything like that, but LinkedIn DMs, easiest way to find me.
Awesome. Well, get on it. Message Mitch if that's something, that program is something that you're interested in. And hey, so good to hang out. Finally got to have this conversation. I'm so stoked.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, hey, if you enjoyed the show, give us a 5-star rating, review wherever you listen. Thanks for hanging out.
We acknowledge the Awabakal people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
We love learning how to do all things well, which is why we have a bunch of different podcasts on a variety of topics. So go and check out My Millennial Investor, My Millennial Money Professional, My Millennial Property, My Millennial Money, My Millennial Daily, and Retire Right. Find these wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.